This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. We're bringing you stories that I think are of interest to men from a whole bunch of different magazines. We're going to start off, believe it or not, there are some stories in People magazine that I think are of interest to men, so let's give it a shot here. This is the November 3rd issue. This one is about suicide prevention, but it's a very personal story of two men who helped each other. A stranger saved him. Now they save others together. There's a picture here of a man standing on the edge, on the outside of the Golden Gate Bridge, wanting to fall to his death and kill himself. And there's a picture, in that picture are a couple of police officers, highway patrolmen from California, standing on the edge talking to him, trying to talk him out of doing it. And apparently they were successful. This is from March 2005. There to listen. Berthia is the guy who wants to jump, spent 92 minutes in March 2005 perched on the edge of the Golden Gate Bridge talking with Sergeant Briggs about his life. At Kevin Berthia's lowest point, Highway Patrolman Kevin Briggs convinced him not to leap from the Golden Gate Bridge. Then the pair teamed up to reach more people in crisis. On the worst morning of his life, on March 11, 2005, Kevin Berthia decided that he was going to drive to the Golden Gate Bridge and jump. A few hours later, the 22-year-old Oakland resident, who had spent years with depression, had just lost his job and was overwhelmed by medical bills after the premature birth of his daughter, found himself balancing on a tiny metal conduit that ran along the outside of the famed landmark, looking down at the frigid waters of San Francisco Bay. "I started my countdown," Berthia says now, "and I braced myself for impact." But before he could leap, California Highway Patrol Sergeant Kevin Briggs spotted him while working the 1.7-mile-long bridge. "Hi," Briggs told the younger man. "Is it okay if I come over and speak with you? I'm not going to touch you. I'm just here to talk with you and to listen." Two decades later, Berthia describes what happened next as a miracle. Briggs, who during his 23-year law enforcement career managed to prevent more than 200 people like Berthia from dying by suicide on the bridge, not only helped persuade Berthia to climb back over the railing, but the two became friends and eventually advocates for others in need. Since 2014, they've been traveling the nation speaking about mental health and helping prevent more suicides, which killed more than 49,000 Americans in 2023, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. "It really is all about just listening and not feeding these folks a bunch of crap," Briggs said. "It's about learning how to talk to someone who is suffering." During the 92 minutes that Berthia spent clinging to the bridge railing 220 feet above the water, he says he shared some of his deepest, darkest secrets for the first time in his life. And that's exactly what Briggs hoped would happen. "I never try to tell anyone what to do," he explains. "I just listen with empathy and understanding, let them speak their piece, then get them to think about coming back over the rail." The pair's paths did not cross again for a long time until 2013, when Berthia, who had spent the ensuing 8 years still lost in the haze of his persistent depression, begrudgingly agreed to present Briggs with an award by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. When he met the man who had convinced him not to end his life nearly a decade earlier, he was floored. Back in 2005, Berthia was so consumed by his suicidal thoughts that even as he talked with Briggs, he never looked up to see his face. "I was like, dang, this whole time it was a cop who saved me," says Berthia. "If I'd known who he was, I never would have opened up to him like that." Their reunion proved life-changing for Berthia, who gave an off-the-cuff speech that floored the hundreds of people in attendance. "I talked about everything that led me to the bridge that day," he says. "For the first time in my life, I was myself, the person that I'd always wanted to be. I was open and honest and vulnerable. And after I got done, the whole room stood up." Briggs, a survivor of cancer and childhood abuse who has faced his own trauma, says, "We've been friends ever since." Berthia insists that their relationship is deeper than that. "We're more like brothers," he says. "What happened that day had nothing to do with him being a white man and me being black. It's all about the power of connection, human connection." In time, Berthia, now 43, discovered the tools he needed to better handle his depression. He also launched an eponymous foundation focused on removing the stigma from mental illness and treatment. He and Briggs, 62, can often be found sharing their gripping story with audiences and empowering others to do what the retired highway patrolman did that day, 2 decades ago on the Golden Gate Bridge. "Never in a million years," marvels Berthia, "did I think that my living in this dark place could help others." That is an awesome story of redemption and people helping each other just by listening. People don't want to be told what to do. They just want somebody to listen. And here's some really important information. If you or anyone you love is thinking about suicide or struggling with mental health challenges, if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health challenges, substance use problems, or just needs to talk, you can call or text 988. That's all you need to do, just like 911, but it's 988. Or you can chat at 988lifeline.org 24/7. Again, just call or text 988, or you can chat, go online and type in 988lifeline.org to chat with someone immediately, and they will help you out with whatever you're struggling with. Next is another story about Bruce Springsteen as it relates to the movie that is coming, that has just come out. I actually saw on Graham Norton last week, Springsteen and Jeremy Allen White, who plays him in the movie, were on Graham Norton and were talking quite a bit about the movie and how Springsteen was there at the set most days, and how you would think it'd be intimidating to the guy playing him, but it actually turned out to be very helpful to him. And he was it was just a great partnership between the two of them. So here's a story about that partnership. Bruce Springsteen's Secret Side. A new biopic pulls back the curtain on a dark period of the boss's life and serves up the biggest challenge for Jeremy Allen White since he broke out on The Bear. And of course, you probably saw him originally on Showtime, the series it was on for, 6-8 years, called Shameless, with William H. Macy and a cast of others. He was definitely the breakout of that show as well. When most people hear Bruce Springsteen's name, they likely think of at least a few things: his nickname, The Boss, his beloved home state, New Jersey, and hits like Born to Run and Dancing in the Dark. The 76-year-old rock star is, as Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, writer and director Scott Cooper says, the soul of America. But the man who wrote seismic anthems like Born in the USA also offers a tender, more vulnerable side to his signature storytelling. That's the facet of the artist that Cooper, 55, explores in his new biopic starring The Bear's Jeremy Allen White. "Set in 1981 and 1982, a very personal moment in my life," Springsteen has said, "the film zeroes in on a burned-out young Springsteen grappling with depression and holing up at a rented farmhouse in the Garden State after touring for his hit 1980 album, The River. Seeking a more stripped-down sound, a major departure from his first 5 studio albums, Springsteen wrote and recorded songs like Atlantic City and Johnny 99 using just a harmonica and an acoustic guitar, forming what ultimately became his dark and daring album, Nebraska. White, age 34, first got a front-row seat to his source material at a Springsteen show packed with 90,000 fans in London. He invited me into his dressing room just about a half an hour before he went on," recalls the actor. "I was so struck by his honesty right from the beginning. The boss went deep. During the emotionally fraught period depicted in the film, White's Springsteen reckons with his difficult childhood and lingering tension with his father, Doug, portrayed by Stephen Graham, who struggled with mental health and alcohol abuse. The musician even experiences a panic attack in one pivotal sequence as he fights with his record label over his new sound. I had a pretty good breakdown when I was 32, Springsteen recently told the Awards Chatter podcast. My family was filled with mental illness, my aunts, my uncles, my pop, and it was just in our blood, so I had to deal with it too. He has said he thought about suicide and told Time that therapy was, a total life changer. Cooper had one goal for two-time Emmy winner White as he pivoted from playing a tortured chef on TV to a rock god. I said, "You're not playing Bruce Springsteen, the global icon. You're not playing the myth. We're stripping all that," says the director. White continued to meet with Springsteen, whom he grew up listening to in Brooklyn, throughout production. "He's always been right on the other end of the phone," White notes. Still, White felt far from a rock star when he began preparing for the role. The actor picked up a guitar for the first time just 7 months before he began filming. "I didn't understand how my fingers were supposed to behave. It was a very humbling start," White says. That's also White's real voice in the film. "Working with a vocal coach, we got into trying to get closer to Bruce's voice," he says. "Then there's certain songs where there was nothing that could have prepared me, you know? I remember recording Born in the USA and losing my voice for a couple of days." Springsteen's longtime producer and friend, John Landau, now 78, was also actively involved in making the film, which depicts the pair's strong bond. Succession's Jeremy Strong plays Landau, who works to keep Springsteen afloat during the musician's dark period. You look at pictures of Bruce and John in those early days with their arms around each other and the smile on their faces, and you can feel the love and the connection between them, says Strong, age 46. On set, personal bonds also grew in the face of tragedy. During the first week of production, the director's father died and his house burned to the ground in the Los Angeles wildfires. Springsteen sprang into action. "He moved my family into his home when our house burned," says Cooper. "My daughter Stella, who was learning guitar when her guitar burned, Bruce promptly sent her one of his. That's who Bruce Springsteen is." Ultimately, what arrived on screen is an anti-biopic, as Springsteen has called Deliver Me From Nowhere. Says Cooper, "I suppose there'll be people who would have preferred that I made a film leading up to Born to Run or a more jukebox musical, a film with all the hits, but rather it's an intimate look at a moment when the boss had to retreat to avoid surrender. Instead of chasing the roar of arenas and chasing number one hits, he chose silence," says the director. "A four-track recorder and a rented bedroom, and the courage to look inward and write what I think is a masterpiece." Springsteen, who has long been pursued by filmmakers to put his story on screen, seems to relish defying biopic expectations. "It just takes a couple years. When I went through some just difficult places in my life," he told the crowd at the Telluride Film Festival, "and I'm old, and I don't give a fuck what I do now." So that is a great intro to Deliver Me From Nowhere, a film that's out right now about the boss, Bruce Springsteen, and it's starring Jeremy Allen White, who is an upcoming star in his own realm, and I think that you'll probably enjoy it. Whether you're a fan of the boss or not, I think it's a movie that is definitely worth seeing. Now, this next story is about a wonderful actress, and I'm bringing it to you because she is currently in a TV show on Netflix that I think is one of the best on TV right now. It just finished its third season. And I'm not kidding you, I literally just watched the last episode of the third season like half an hour ago. So this is really fresh in my mind. And I wanted to bring this story to you because it's just, she's an incredible actress. And this show is, like I said, probably one of the best on TV. And I love these kinds of shows that, like West Wing and others, that it kind of brings you the backstory. It sort of takes you behind the scenes, behind the curtain of places like the White House. And in this case, it's the diplomatic section of London, where she's an ambassador to London and he's the vice president of the United States. And I know it's not real. It's not real life, but it sure kind of feels like it. It feels right and true. But anyway, here's a story about Carrie Russell. Carrie Russell is still the girl next door. Nearly 30 years after she broke out on Felicity, the star of The Diplomat remains refreshingly relatable. On the rare occasion that Carrie Russell has a day off, she's most likely up early before her three kids are awake. She makes a coffee, listens to the news, and might even hop on her bike to ride around Brooklyn, which she and her partner of more than a decade, actor Matthew Rhys, calls home. On the most ideal hypothetical version of that day off, no one's fighting, everyone has everything they need, Russell says. Just easy stuff. If that doesn't sound like the life of a typical Hollywood star, that's by design. Russell, 49, who shares son River, 18, and daughter Willa, with her ex-husband Shane Deary, and son Sam, 9, with Reese, 50, would rather stay home than uproot her family to a set in the UK, where the two seasons of her political drama, The Diplomat, were filmed. For season 3, now streaming on Netflix, part of the production was moved to New York, and Russell could even ride her bike to the set. We'd still go to London, but for a much briefer time, she says, noting that she loved the summer she spent there with her kids, especially since it meant Reese, who grew up in Wales, got to go home a lot. Russell, a native of Fountain Valley, California, and an alum of the 1990s Mickey Mouse Club revival, calls The Diplomat one of my favorite shows I've ever worked on. That's high praise considering her resume includes the 1998 to 2002 drama Felicity, which first endeared her to viewers as the titular love-struck college kid, and the acclaimed 2013 to 2018 thriller The Americans, for which she earned 5 Lead Actress Emmy nominations. It's also where she met Reese, who co-starred as her husband. They quietly dated for a year before going public. Now, I'll tell you, I've not watched The Americans yet, but that's on my list of shows to binge watch here shortly, because that, again, that was also an excellent show from what I've heard. On The Diplomat, Russell plays whip-smart but fallible Kate Wyler, the U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom, alongside Rufus Sewell as her hard-headed husband Hal, and Allison Janney, who joined in season 2 as Vice President Grace Penn. Says Russell, "It's fun to play someone so smart, so funny, so fierce. She does stupid shit all the time, but I also love that she can pull it together and be presentable and put on a dress if she needs to." Actually, her character is notoriously adverse to wearing gowns, though she's forced to anyway as part of her job glad-handing dignitaries. Russell feels the same way. "I tend to want to be more comfortable and feel cool versus beautiful and sexy," says the actress, who admits she went through a period where she wore the same leather jacket over and over, which Reese, whom she calls my guy, affectionately teased her about. Russell's own decades in show business make it easier to relate to the way her character Kate is scrutinized by the media. "It's such a weird thing being a woman. Everyone has an opinion about the way you look, the way you dress, the way your hair is," she says. "That's just the nature of our society. I like how cranky Kate is about it. I love it. I find it delightful. The topic of appearance is something my girlfriends and I talk about all the time," continues Russell. "I feel like plastic surgery is having such a moment right now. We're inundated with these movie stars who, even though they might be 50 or 60, they look like they're 25. And then I watch this show and I'm like, huh, I do not look like that. But I have to say, I like the way I look in this show. Unnatural perfection isn't her vibe anyway. I certainly do not look like I'm doing a beautiful makeup campaign, but I find solace in that," she adds. "It makes me feel good and normal." Our next story is about one of my favorite filmmakers, Cameron Crowe. I tell you what, one of the movies that I will always stop and watch if I'm flipping channels and I come across it is Almost Famous. I don't care what part of the movie it's in, I will stop and watch it because I love that movie. And one that you probably may not even remember is called Elizabethtown, with Orlando Bloom and Kirsten Dunst, and where his father dies and he goes back to where he lived in Kentucky, which is a real place, by the way, and has to be around his dad's family and friends. It is an awesome movie. And Cameron Crowe has been part of some of the best movies of all time. So let's find out more about him. "Hanging out with my heroes. In a new memoir, the Jerry Maguire and Almost Famous director looks back on his star-studded life and career. Most kids can only dream of meeting their favorite stars, but before he even had his driver's license, Cameron Crowe was spending time with them at their most vulnerable. As a teenage journalist for outlets like Rolling Stone and Cream, he logged quality FaceTime with some of rock's greatest legends throughout the 1970s. Crowe joined Led Zeppelin on tour for a 1975 Rolling Stone cover story and class credit at San Diego City College, spent a whirlwind 18 months with David Bowie in the mid-70s, and in 1979 won over beautiful rebel Joni Mitchell during what he still calls his best interview. Experiences that later inspired his 2000 semi-autobiographical film, Almost Famous, which he wrote and directed. "My mom always used to say, Seek out your heroes. What's the worst that could happen, he says. For Crow, 68, that bit of wisdom led to a one-of-a-kind career as a writer and filmmaker, which he recounts in his new memoir, The Uncool, which is out October 28th. The book covers his California childhood with his parents, Alice and James, and older sisters, Kathy and Cindy, family tragedies, and the almost too-good-to-be-true stories of his time with pop culture icons. After years spent writing about other people, you may not know that he wrote the screenplay for the landmark 1982 teen comedy Fast Times at Ridgemont High after spending a year as an undercover high school student in his early 20s. I guess because he looked so young. Crow really hit his stride in the late 80s as a movie director. He's helmed beloved films like 1989's Say Anything and 1996's Jerry Maguire, and worked with everyone from Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz to his ex-wife Nancy Wilson of Heart. But it was Almost Famous that made Crow a king of cult classics and earned him the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay in 2001. Recounting his own life story through fictional teen reporter William Miller, played by Patrick Fugit, was achingly personal, he says, and so was working with the ensemble cast that also included Billy Crudup and Kate Hudson. Crow remembers shooting a scene with Hudson in New York City's Central Park, where her character, the groupie Penny Lane, reveals her real name, Lady Goodman, shortly after attempting suicide. We just all spontaneously hugged each other, he says. You feel everything that happened. I'm just so grateful that we had the gift of being able to make it. Crow's incredible journey hasn't been without darkness. His oldest sister, Kathy, died by suicide when she was 19 and Crow was 10. She was a huge fan of the Beach Boys, and her passion for music influenced the trajectory of her kid brother's life, which is not the suicide part, but her influence of music is a part of the storyline in Almost Famous. She really taught me how to listen to music and let music in, he says. She taught me how pop music could be frothy and deeply meaningful at the same time. That's the reason I wanted to write the book. I wanted to thank her. Crow was also guided by his mother, a former professor who died at 97, shortly before the Almost Famous musical premiered in San Diego in 2019. A lifelong theater lover, Alice saw the production as a legacy for his twin sons, Curtis and William, 25, whom he shares with Wilson. He also has a daughter, Vivian, 11 months, with girlfriend Anais Smith. When the show opened, Crow kept his mom's seat empty in the audience. Writing The Uncool was a way for Crow to pay tribute to the myriad of vivid characters, professional and personal, who helped shape his unforgettable and inspiring ride. Take a little optimism with you, he says, sharing his own motto. Something is waiting if you just don't give up. Life will surprise you in the most spectacularly original ways. So if you ever get a chance, check out Elizabethtown, of course, Jerry Maguire, Say Anything, Almost Famous, any number of movies that Cameron Crowe has done. He hasn't done one in a while, but I guess this is what he's been working on, this book. So the book is called The Uncool, a Memoir, by Cameron Crowe, and that's my next book that I'm going to reserve at the library because I definitely want to read that. Our next story is coming to us from the Saturday Guardian magazine, which is a United Kingdom, British newspaper and magazine, October 25th of 2025. And this one is a great story about arguably the hottest actor in Hollywood right now, and that's Glenn Powell. He's in several movies. he's in a TV series right now, called Chad Powers. He's got, a new movie coming out, which is a remake of Running Man, which had Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he just finished up in Twisters last year. And then he was in Anything But You with, Sydney Sweeney. He's all over the place right now. And, here's a story about falling for Glenn Powell. He's an old-fashioned actor in a digital age, making box office smashes like Top Gun, Maverick, Twisters, and Anyone But You. Now he's lining up projects with everyone from Ron Howard to Edgar Wright, and Marina Hyde can't get enough of him. She heads to Hollywood to meet Texas's answer to Tom Cruise. There's that famous line in the first episode of The Sopranos, where Tony laments his place in the timeline. Lately, I'm getting the feeling, he confides, that I came in at the end. The best is over. I know Tony was talking about the mindful joy of building an incredibly violent, organized crime enterprise from the ground up. But lately, I've been thinking about his words every time I watch Glenn Powell giving it 200% as a movie star. Glenn Powell is Hollywood's hottest mid-level actor, but because of the harsh realities of modern movie stardom, a lot of people still don't know who he is. You get the feeling he's coming in at the end of something. Yet barely a week goes by where I don't hear of an uncast starring role, The Bodyguard in The Bodyguard remake, The Cyber Criminal in The Matrix remake, The Hot Soldier in The Starship Troopers remake, and not think, tell you what, Glenn Powell could do that for you. Glenn Powell could deliver that. He's not going to turn up late to set. He's going to work harder than anyone else. He's going to promote the arse out of it. And if all that can open a wormhole back to the era when literally everyone knew who movie stars were, then Glenn Powell is sure as hell going to take the opportunity. He is quite simply a one-man cargo cult for Hollywood's vanished primacy. I'm kidding, of course, because the good news I discover as I sit with him is that you can kid around with Glenn Powell, actor, writer, proud Texan, and also condiment tycoon at a price point America can afford. More on that later, rest assured. Truly, I don't know how anyone takes themselves seriously in this job, he laughs, and yet so many do, Glenn. But I really don't. It's so funny. On every movie, I literally sit there thinking, there's no way you can be a self-serious person and do this job well, because it's just so ridiculous. It's hard to disagree, thinking back to this morning's photo shoot, where I watched Glenn wearing an extremely expensive top-to-toe purple outfit while wiping the floor after a little accident by his internet-famous dog, Brisket. A beguiling fluffball, Brisket has attended a lot of premieres and takes second billing to Glenn, for now. You have to remember, this is a dog-eat-dog business. In the flesh, Glenn is chirpily handsome and Category 5 amiable, a sort of Mickey Mouse Club version of James Dean. He's about to open an Edgar Wright's remake of The Running Man, based on the Stephen King novel, another of those dystopian fictions that sees society as a death game that are, for whatever reason, having a long cultural moment. I've watched everything Edgar has ever done, Glenn enthuses, and it's fun thinking of him enjoying the lost British males of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and The World's End, and then offering up his own all-American hunkdom to the Wright vision. So we're in a big moment for Glenn Powell, yet simultaneously, he's fully aware that being a major movie star is a different game from what it was last time this particular action title was on cinema marquees. The year, 1987, the star, Mr. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, he smiles, it'll never be what it used to be. We're being brought takeaway pasta at a picnic table on the Paramount Pictures lot, perhaps fittingly, the last bit of Hollywood still located in actual Hollywood. And I've tactically ordered ravioli because it's the least messy, and I'm worried about having 2 feet of spaghetti trailing out of my mouth while I'm asking Glenn Powell about the fracturing of shared contemporary culture. Glenn's gone for something involving significant amounts of one of those spiky lettuces that Americans have fancy names for. Could be dangerous. Anyway, the lost past. Glenn likes to tell a story about the education he received around a decade ago on The Expendables 3. Important Glenn Powell fact. He loves nothing more than an education and is fully committed to meeting his heroes and learning everything about the business from them. The Expendables is the franchise where Sylvester Stallone keeps getting a bunch of action stars from the 1980s and 1990s together for one last job. On Glenn's iteration of the series, he was in the gang with Stallone, Harrison Ford, Schwarzenegger, Wesley Snipes, Mel Gibson, Dolph Lundgren, and Antonio Banderas, the full action retirement community. All those guys were so great, he remembers. They were legends, and they were like, man, you're doing this at the wrong time. Does he wish he were born that earlier time, a bit like Stripe of modern British politician who secretly imagines that they've been just the man for the bygone glories of the 20th or even the 19th centuries? Look, every era of Hollywood has the sky is falling mentality. It was always better back then. But my favorite movies are like from the 90s and the early 2000s. That's what I grew up watching and what made me come out here to LA. He certainly remade a few of them, or at least starred in modern reboots of them. His serious breakout was in 2022's Top Gun, Maverick as Hangman, the spiritual heir to Val Kilmer's swaggering Iceman in the original. Then there was Twisters, a sequel to the mid-90s Twister, and now The Running Man, while one of the many projects in the pipeline is a Ron Howard movie about firefighters, which it's hard not to feel is at least in the Backdraft extended universe. Surely one can teleport our entire culture back to the golden age of action stardom? But there's also the other side of his career. Movies such as the 2023 neo-noir hit Hitman, co-written with Richard Linklater, which made some film snoots suddenly feel differently about him. I love that movie. That's a great movie. And the small matter of his saving rom-coms twice with Set It Up in 2018, huge for Netflix, and 2023's Anyone But You, where he starred opposite bombshell-turned-culture wars lightning rod Sydney Sweeney and served up a surprise box office hit. That one came with a side performance of Fomance, as the pair allowed the media to think they were maybe dating to promote the film. They weren't. Meanwhile, he's co-written Chad Powers, a new TV sports comedy for Hulu, and just wrapped up on Ghost Rider, a fantasy film for J.J. Abrams. It's quite the mix. If you meet my family, he explains, you'll probably see why. Vital Glenn Powell fact. Glenn Powell is utterly devoted to his parents. Glenn Sr., an executive coach, and Cindy, a homemaker and frequent cameo in his movies. Ditto the two sisters he falls in the middle of. Leslie is a musician, and Lauren has just given birth to her second set of twins. This would be a family where you go see a Yankees game and a Broadway show in one day. I love Gene Kelly, and I love Bruce Willis, but they were homebodies too. Oh yeah, you go to the ranch in Texas and the kitchen, that's where all life happened. And you love rom-coms. Well, I grew up with sisters and so many female cousins. The women in the Powell family really run the roost. I mean, my dad took my mom's last name. Well, fancy that, right? But actually, there's something about rom-coms. A lot of actors tell me their favorite movies, and I'm like, that's dark. I always like movies that are rewatchable, that fill you up. Comforting things? Yeah, comforting things. I sort of like escapist things where you're not pulling people's energy, you're giving them energy. And that's what rom-coms are to me. He can quote Legally Blonde in its entirety. In fact, because of the meeting, his heroes thing, Glenn made it his business to connect with Karen McCullough, the great rom-com writer who gave us Legally Blonde. And then he knew just who he had to introduce her to. When my family met Karen McCullough, it was like they were meeting the Beatles. Even so, movie romance feels endangered. There was a study saying intimacy on screen had decreased 40% since the millennium. Glenn, I'm worried hot people aren't getting it on in the movies as much as they used to. Is that right? Why do you think that is? I don't know, changing tastes in a disheartened, disinherited generation? I tell them I noted the last scene of Twisters seemed to be him asking for Daisy Edgar-Jones' informed consent to even phone her. Although I read they did film a kiss, but the director didn't use it. I blame myself, Glenn cackles. Just botched a kiss? I tried. I did my best. You see, he looks like this alpha, macho, watch-loving guy, but he's always out there subverting it. Maybe that's the Glenn Powell special sauce, not the actual sauce. We'll get to the sauce in a minute. I mean, it's not a conscious thing. You know, I grew up with big dogs, and when I was going to adopt a dog, I went to look at big dogs. But then I liked Brisket. A little fluffy, cute, part chihuahua was not in the plan, but we found each other. I realize Glenn reminds me a lot of the old Athena poster of the hot, shirtless guy holding the baby. If you're my age or over, you'll remember it. If you're younger, all you need to tell you is that this was the biggest selling poster of the 1980s and made the photographer so much money that he bought a plane. Having said that, Glenn's vibe wasn't ringing the tills for a long while back there. He dropped out of his University of Texas degree in Spanish and early American history. Of course, he's now completing his degree at age 37 remotely while shooting films. Glenn Powell sees things through. Also, it would make his mother really happy. He moved to LA with the kind of charmed introduction that must have felt like he was 10 minutes from stardom. Denzel Washington, who cast a teenage Powell in The Great Debaters, hooked him up with his agent, Ed LaMotto. At which point, Glenn settled into a long, long period of rejection and disappointment. I heard he flunked auditions for Han Solo and Captain America. He pauses to dentally extract a particularly lengthy piece of lettuce. Now you're talking about the big ones, but I also failed a lot of auditions for really bad jobs, like some really bad roles. So you had range? Oh yeah, I had real range in my failure. I didn't get cast in some really bad movies too. Things took a serious downward turn when LaMotta died in 2010. Glenn still remembers exactly where he was when he got the call that the agency was dropping him. I knew that would be the beginning of a really tough road. You had a guy who was the top of the food chain and he was really looking out for me, but when he died, I got let go. I knew I was in for a scrappy little run. On the plus side, those agents will be massively kicking themselves now. Oh, I talked to some of them. They're still my friends. But I do give them shit about it, he confirms with a twinkle. You have to, but maybe not becoming famous in your 20s is good. Oh man, I think it's really good, honestly. We then have to pause for the extraction of a piece of lettuce so big it needs its own trailer. One thing LaMotta managed to do for Powell before he died was get him a job reading scripts for the late producer and writer Linda Obst, responsible for movies from Sleepless in Seattle to Interstellar. He adored it. It was a really cool thing. She was one of those really special producers. You know, Texans have this really weird thing. Sorry, wait, you're from Texas? Ha, I haven't told anyone. Break the story that I'm Texan. But listen, Texans really do care about other Texans. Even honorary ones do. Obst was born in New York, but had made a home in Texas. She was a Longhorn, so I got to go and sit on the Sony lot and read scripts for her. I was the fastest reader by far. I did 3 scripts a day. Flash forward several years to Tom Cruise offering a role in Top Gun Maverick, and Glenn is A, broke, and B, really knows what he needs from a script. And somewhat bizarrely, given A, he almost didn't take the part of Hangman, summoning the confidence to push back against the original script until Cruise reconfigured his character's place within it. But doing that way was the greatest decision I ever made. It could have been me sitting on the sidelines, kicking my heels, thinking, man, I burned a few years. But it was the best film school. The fact that Tom is such a close friend now, when I got Running Man, he was literally my first call. I said, dude, you've been doing this for decades. He's picked up every trick in the book, and he's so generous. I thought I was going to talk to him for 10 minutes. He stayed on the phone for 2 hours plus. Give us a peek at the Tom Cruise trick book then. He's like, tell me some of the stunts you're doing. I said, okay, I'm jumping off exploding bridges, falling off roofs. He said, are you running at night? Yes. Okay, that means you'll probably wrap at 5 in the morning. Don't do any sprinting shops at 5 in the morning. Your body's going to be out of whack and you'll get hurt. There's always going to do a wet down at night. A wet down is when the crew hose down the ground, both because the reflections look cooler in the dark, but also because it hides tire skids or footprints or whatever for continuity. So Tom says, that's fine if you're running straight. If you're taking a corner, no. This is when meeting your heroes saves you a torn knee ligament. What else? He goes, if you're hanging 11 stories up, make sure people see how high you are. Make sure the shot reflects depth and dimension. You're selling the fact that you are doing these things. Something a lot of people say in these days of endless CGI is that there's kind of an empty feeling when you know it was all just done on green screen. It doesn't really connect. Is this why Tom Cruise and now you want to do as many as possible of your own stunts? Right, it really sells it because if the audience knows that you're really in peril, there is an inherent investment. I believe you have to give the audience their value in the ticket. If people are actively going to the theater, getting a babysitter, maybe doing dinner, you got to justify that ticket price. And that's what Tom always talks about. You have to have skin on the line. If they're showing up for you, you've got to show up for them. But bingo cards at the ready, because the next movie Glenn will shoot will be something he co-wrote with Judd Apatow, in which he shows up as, get this, a country singer. I've always been so nervous to sing, he admits. I was obsessed with Elvis as a kid. And my little sister used to sell Girl Scout cookies, and there was a honeysuckle bush next to our house. And for everyone that bought one of her cookies, I gave them an Elvis song. But I couldn't sing in front of them, so I hid behind the honeysuckle bush and sang, oh, Glenn, I think I just OD'd on Americana. Will Judd Apatow be providing you with a honeysuckle bush? No, I have to do it in front of everyone. It seems as good a time as any to say that I wonder if it's hard being all-American in such a divided America. Good question. Yeah, he exhales. I'm not a political person. I like things that bring people together. Sure, but it feels like you're the type of actor who wants to be for everyone, and that's getting so much harder now there are fewer parts of culture enjoyed by both sides, as it were. Take something like late-night television, which back in the glory days of David Letterman was TV watched by everybody, of all political leanings, but it's now perceived to be siloed for only one side. And that's what remains of late night. Soon after this interview, Jimmy Kimmel was temporarily yanked off the air, and then, of course, was allowed back. Maybe action movies are one of the last bastions of truly shared American culture. That's a good point. There's a universal language in action, which is also why those movies translate so well internationally. Running Man is about something universal. What would you be willing to do for the people you love? But also how people can feel powerless in the face of a world that feels more and more unequal, more unfair. So you're not going to see me talk politics, but movies, that's how I express myself. Movies are a conversation. Politics always felt to me like two people trying to prove a point. Unfortunately and undoubtedly, though, the erosion of shared mainstream culture makes that conversation smaller than it was. I say to Glenn that it's as if there are fewer and fewer people who everyone is permitted to like, no matter what side they're on. The Rock's one, and maybe Travis Kelce. He agrees. Of all the people coming up to big-time stardom in recent years, I would have picked him and Sydney Sweeney as having that kind of broad appeal. Except now, Sweeney's been mired in a raging culture war after some people decided a denim advertisement in which she participated was, I can't quite believe I'm typing this, but it is, after all, 2025, eugenicist. Something to do with good genes, J-E-A-N-S, and good genes, G-E-N-E-S, apparently. But please don't dig further. Every second spent on it will just make you stupider. Which probably should say more stupid, right? But put politely, I tell Glenn, I thought this was bullshit. And yet I don't think people in the business came out to defend her. Is it because it's just a relief that the firestorm isn't happening to them at that moment? Or is it a form of cowardice? A pause. Not lettuce related. I think people weighed in on it, he says, of the Sweeney firestorm. I don't, I say. I think she was left to twist in the wind. But I think people are aware that it's bullshit. Yet they didn't say that publicly. Look, in an era in which businesses are evolving and are seeing their mortality in front of them, sometimes they're desperate to make anything run. Whether it's true or not, whether it hurts anyone, there's no accountability anymore. I think he's talking about the news media and how it operates in a digital age, because if you think Hollywood is past its heyday, then it's got nothing on journalism. Back in the day, stars gave reflective, candid interviews, and those discussions sat relatively isolated in magazines and color supplements or on evanescent episodes of celebrated talk shows. But these days, people want a news line or six out of an interview, and they want to put it in the headline, even though they know it's going to get scraped and clipped from here to kingdom come by every clickbait news website out there within moments of it dropping online. And why is, this is why celebrities don't want to say anything eye-catching in interviews anymore. This is why we can't have reflective things. Any star, any author, any musician, anyone in the entertainment business these days who sits down to an interview has one overwhelming goal: to not make news. I tell Glenn I can see why people would never really want to offer an opinion, because then you've got 3 days of Glenn Powell wades into Sydney Sweeney discourse headlines, and it's a nightmare and a distraction, and it gets in the way of the work you want to do. Is that what it feels like? Another pause. The sad part is you do have to separate yourself, he sighs. You can't get caught up in it. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with ad dollars. And you know, there is no course correcting. If something's false, you're not actually setting the record straight. You're just feeding the beast. That's why I don't say shit. Just let it come and let it go. Not feeding the beast and not trying to fight anything. I've realized the smart people in Hollywood don't try to fight anything that has nothing to do with them. And yet, when all eyes were on Jimmy Kimmel's return after their controversial suspension, who should turn up as his very first guest? Why, I do believe it was Mr. Glenn Powell bringing a smile and a care package of worn anecdotes and declaring straight out of the gate that he was honored to be here, and who should be pictured shortly thereafter at Sydney Sweeney's space-themed birthday wearing a hilariously cheap NASA astronaut costume that I refuse to believe he didn't buy on Amazon? Well, you get the point. Still, he must fear it'll be his turn to be in the wood chipper for something one of these days. Oh, it's inevitable. It's not an if, it's when. It's been an adjustment. I try to be honest, work really hard, and treat people well. That's how I try to move through my life. Inevitably, you're going to catch some strays, but that's the nature of the job, and I've watched it happen to other people. Tangentially, it strikes me that the job has morphed beyond anything it was in the past. Remember when Mark Wahlberg's routine dropped online and it involved him getting up at 2:30 a.m. for the first of several workouts, as well as having to incorporate meetings, prayer time, and the conflicting demands of family interaction and cryo chamber recovery? Glenn laughs. In the modern style, even he is capable of giving a detailed explanation of the type of physique required for Ben Richards, his character in The Running Man. He works in a factory. He's a guy whose body is like a tool. So I wanted him to be strong and durable, blue-collar strong, but not like he goes to a gym. Needless to say, this requires a significant amount of time in the gym. It must be weird to get into this job because you like the feeling of acting, and the bit where you're doing that specific thing ends up being a small fraction of your time, around all the meetings and the photo shoots and the endless workouts and whatnot. Perhaps this is why, for all his easy charm, Glenn has flipped to finding movie sets the same places of the world. Do you know what's hit me in the last little bit? I love acting. I love the process of bringing a team of people together, and we all come together and make something really cool. I'm not exhausted by that. It's fun. But the exhausting part, the part that throws me, is when I'm in the real world right now. On a movie set, you have your head down, you're collaborating with people. It feels very ordinary. But the part I'm getting used to is this other thing. Fame? Yeah, I'm still figuring it out. He has at least figured out how to shift a load of ketchup. As mentioned, the modern actor has to be very diversified. So back in April, Powell launched Smash Kitchen, a range of organic ketchups and mustards and mayonnaises, ideal for pairing with the great Texas cuisine of barbecue. It's already sold more than 1 million units in its first 3 months and is expanding at pace. As for where it's sold, Walmart, obviously. Cheapest sauce in the range is under $2. Nothing costs more than $5. I mean, it's too on the nose and yet unavoidable. Glenn Powell wants to be mass market, both as a movie star and a sauce mogul. Sauce mogul. Sauce mogul. I have not heard that before, he says. Maybe the best thing success has brought him, apart from unlimited condiments, was the right to move back to Texas and escape from L.A. When this town feels like Hollywood is happening here, there's nothing better. And when it's not, then it's a harder place to live. But I always wanted to go back to Texas. That's where my family is. That's where my friends are. I have friends here, but I can bring them back to Texas. As he points out, it helps that Hollywood decentralized overnight in the pandemic because of Zoom, self-taping, a general cultural shift. It's no longer a brick-and-mortar business. It's no longer a lot of things, but it's great that Glenn has conquered it sufficiently to be allowed to WFT, work from Texas. Which about wraps us up, bar my minor panic that the interview has not, in fact, recorded. The problem, I tell him as I fiddle doubtfully with the recording device, is I don't do many interviews. In fact, I honestly don't think I've done one for more than a decade. That's a long time. Who was it? I think it was a politician called Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage, says Glenn? I've never heard of him. Well, short answer, it's just possible he's going to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom one of these days. So what this logically means, Glenn Powell, is that in around 13 years, you're going to have to drop what you're doing and be Prime Minister. Ha! Listen, in a darkening world, we can only live in hope. The Running Man is in cinemas on November the 7th. So get out there and watch The Running Man. And remember, if you're old enough, you'll remember the original Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Richard Dawson played the game show host. I'm not sure who does it here, but it looks like a great movie. And Glenn Powell is what seems to be a regular guy who lives in Texas and just happens to make movies. I'm going to end the hour with a story from Men's Fitness Magazine, dated November 2025, excuse me. Is your grooming routine sabotaging your gains? Look good, feel good. Well, yes and no. Your grooming regimen might be affecting your skin, your hormones, and even your gym recovery. How about that? You've splashed it out on supplements, recovery tools, a gym membership, and a range of at-home workout essentials to help you hit PBs, optimize your health, and look your best. But have you ever considered the impact that your grooming routine might be having on your well-being? Yep, the very thing that makes you feel fresh and sharp might be messing with your skin, your hormones, and even your gym recovery. It's time to rethink these grooming habits. Too hot to handle. A hot steaming shower after a heavy leg day might be your secret antidote to speedy muscle recovery, but next time you're subjecting yourself to a fiery wash, considering turning the temperature down a touch. Not only can too hot of water strip your skin of its natural oils and leave you dry, itchy, and uncomfortable, but prolonged exposure, such as baths, hot tubs, long hot showers, and saunas, can affect your male hormones, in particular testosterone, which is made predominantly in the testes. As testosterone is the key player in your muscle growth, bone strength, libido, and sperm production, it makes sense to protect it. Testosterone also boosts confidence, focus, and mood. Healthy testosterone keeps men strong, lean, and motivated, says Dr. Utka Donmez, a GMC-registered medical doctor at ProMeds Clinic. The testes function best at a slightly lower, cooler temperature than the rest of the body, and even a small increase between 2 and 4 degrees Celsius in scrotal temperature can reduce both sperm production and testosterone output, says Dr. Donmez. Past research has even found that frequent wet heat exposure, such as regular post-gym hot tub use, can lead to temporary infertility by lowering sperm production and movement. Overheating the testicles hampers the sperm-making spells, which need cooler conditions to produce healthy sperm. But these effects are often reversible once the heat exposure is reduced or stopped, adds Dr. Damez. An occasional hot soak is okay, but don't make it a habit. Keep baths to a maximum of 10 minutes long and aim for a comfortable temperature of around 35 to 40 degrees Celsius rather than maximum heat. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit, probably 80 degrees, 85 degrees, something like that. This level of warmth relaxes muscles and improves circulation without overheating your core or your groin. You never want to overheat your groin, right? It can also improve sleep quality by helping your body cool down afterward, explains Dr. Donmez. Also, overwashing is bad for you. Nothing beats the feeling of a good sweat sesh, but that workout glow can be a double-edged sword for your skin, especially if you let it sit for too long. Sweat leaves salt, oil, and bacteria on the skin. If it's not washed off, this can clog pores and trigger acne or folliculitis, infected hair follicles, also known as gym acne, says Dr. Ed Robinson, a cosmetic aesthetics doctor at Dr. Ed Robinson Aesthetics Clinic. In fact, sweat creates a warm, damp environment on your skin where bacteria and fungi thrive. If you don't rinse off, this can lead to body acne, rashes, or fungal overgrowth such as ringworm or athlete's foot. But don't scrub away your sweat excessively. Overwashing with harsh soaps or strong exfoliating skincare products strips the skin barrier, causing dryness and irritation, adds Dr. Robinson. A gentle pH balance cleanser post-workout is the best middle ground, followed by a moisturizer to help restore the skin's hydration. Try Cetaphil, Cetaphil, for gentle cleansers. No time to shower? At least change out of your sweaty kit into something fresh. Wipe down exposed skin with a clean, damp cloth or cleansing wipe. This prevents that bacteria-laden sweat from lingering on your skin and clogging pores, says Dr. Denmes. Oh, and don't forget your feet. Dry between toes and use antifungal powders if needed to reduce the chances of athlete foot and nail infections, which can sideline training, adds Dr. Robinson. After all, do you really want to miss your next gym session thanks to a nasty skin infection? Smooth moves. If you're a cyclist, swimmer, or bodybuilder, then hair removal might be top of your agenda. And if you're a proud owner of a beard, you're probably no stranger to grooming, trimming, and shaping either. Hair removal isn't inherently dangerous, but it does make your skin slightly more vulnerable to irritation and infection if you're not careful, says Dr. Donmez. In fact, a study of the Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal found that footballers who shaved their bodies were 6 times more likely to develop MRSA, a type of skin infection, than those who didn't. Shaving, especially with a razor, can irritate the skin's barrier. If bacteria are present on the skin or equipment, they have an easier entity. Ingrown hairs are another common issue. These can cause red, inflamed bumps, sometimes with pus if it gets infected. Avoid sore skin by shaving after a warm shower so that hair and skin is softer. Shave in the direction of hair growth and replace disposable razors every 5 to 7 uses. Post-shave, apply an alcohol-free, soothing aftershave or moisturizer to calm your skin. Time your hair removal so you have at least a few hours before your next workout. This allows your skin time to recover. Waxing, avoid hot showers, saunas, and heavy workouts for 24 hours after defuzzing. Product overload. From creams to lotions to sprays and gels, the products in your cabinet could contain endocrine-disrupting chemicals, which can mimic, block, or interfere with your body's own hormones. Disruption at homes can impact everything from muscle growth and fat loss to energy, sleep, and fertility. Even the smallest disruptions in hormones can make training less effective, slow recovery, and cause fatigue. Dr. Denmas says that parabens and phthalates in particular, chemicals often found in personal care products, could be problematic. Parabens are preservatives which stop mold and bacteria growing, while phthalates are chemicals that help scents to last longer. Some phthalates used in plastics and fragrances can reduce testosterone production in animal models and have been linked to lower testosterone and sperm counts in exposed rodents. Rodent studies on parabens found that high doses of certain parabens could lower male rats' testosterone levels and impair sperm production. As for humans, some correlations have been observed which indicate that these chemicals could impact male reproductive health, decreasing testosterone or sperm quality. Men with higher levels of phthalate metabolites in their urine have been found in some studies to have slightly lower blood testosterone than those with lower exposure. A 2017 study of men at a fertility clinic also showed that men with higher paraben concentrations had lower sperm motility and more abnormal sperm. They also had slightly lower testosterone levels on average. The bottom line. Ultimately, grooming doesn't have to derail your health, but being aware of the link between what you put on and do to your body can help you optimize your daily performance. Smart grooming is part of a healthy training lifestyle, says Dr. Donmas. Use heat in moderation because while it's great for muscles, you need to protect your skin and fertility. Keep your skin clean, but not overstripped. Be mindful with hair removal and avoid chemicals that might mess with your hormones. So there's a lot of good advice here on things to avoid or things to do different, like taking a cooler shower, staying out of that hot tub and the sauna for more than just a little bit of time. Be careful about what you shave and how you shave it, and be careful what fragrances and chemicals you put on your body. It's pretty simple, but I don't know. I'm a 66-year-old male, so the ideas in this make a lot of sense to me. People of our age have a little trouble in these areas, so it's always good to find other ways to hopefully increase my viability in that area. So maybe it's something for you to look at too. Anyway, we're out of time, so tune in again next week, and please stay tuned for all the great programming right here on Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Take care, everybody. Oh, and happy Halloween.